Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out on a long weekend, a lovely day. As you know, we're going to begin practice period soon, and the theme for the practice period is going to be looking at, in our life, both suffering and resilience. So in a way, this talk, I realize, is kind of a prep talk, kind of warm up a little bit for what's coming in the next weeks. And I called this Choosing the World. And part of the, for me, the inspiration or desire to look into this came on our trip that Kate and I did to Banff and the Rockies, feeling the beauty as well as the kind of mystery of the world, which is much easier to feel in the Rockies than it is, you know, kind of in our everyday life, being knocked around by this and that. And also from some of the reading that I was doing to prepare for the practice period. So at some point in our life, in our practice, we become aware of a choice. We can choose the world, or we can choose our world. The world as it is, or the world of our stories. The stance of choosing our world, I think, includes a kind of grudging acknowledgement that we are in this world, but an insistence not to be of it. The world we want is mostly free of thwarted desires, injustice, uncontrolled changes, and free of the troubles of earthly reality. So, caught in this ongoing struggle to create our world, we forget there is a choice. Perhaps there are a few who become really, you know, aware of the possibility of the choice quite early on. But I didn't. And I suggest most of us really only become aware gradually that we have a choice. And this usually occurs some point in adulthood. The choice for the world as it is seems stark, harsh, perhaps. And I really think we can only choose having suffered and struggled enough. And we make this choice over and over again. For so much of our life, we struggle to create our world. Our world, the one where each of us is the hero, or at least the main character, around which the whole drama of this universe revolves. And this is reinforced by the prevailing and really strong injunction to create our life, to be strong, to be independent, to be the best, sexy, powerful, and most of all, to be in control. Subtly, and yet I think within each of us, there is an unexamined premise that our life, my life, your life, arises from the narrative that we create for our world. So we struggle to get the narrative right, or struggle to fit our actual life into the narrative that we've been given. I said, given, because for many of us, or maybe for most of us, the narrative is not really our own creation. It's been given to us by parents, by teachers, friends, companions, social messages. The details vary, of course, but our narrative is about, whatever this means, the good life. And then we feed an expectation of happiness, excitement, romance, success, fame, wealth of some kind. We want some of those things, maybe all those things, with just enough challenge to show how great we are. We've overcome challenges to get this stuff, right? So that's one kind of narrative that many of us have at some point. Seemingly really positive, perhaps, with many worthwhile attributes. And yet we gravely wound ourselves trying to make this narrative our reality, because inevitably we fall short. The outer world does not follow the tracks laid down by our own personal narrative. And failing to understand the kind of incongruity that's arising, we struggle. We struggle like Sisyphus, the Greek guy who ended up rolling the stone up the hill to roll back down again. Endlessly trying to roll our own narrative into reality. Our narratives, our stories, don't map onto the outside world. Our everyday life doesn't follow our storyline for very long, if at all. And yet, we keep trying to get it right. The fault, we assume, is not so much with the narrative, the story, and maybe not even that much of the outside world, but the fault is with me. Somehow broken, somehow inadequate. And that's what we struggle to fix and refix and refix. But of course, we spin and are given many kinds of narratives. Another may be really how inadequate we are, how flawed and broken and impossible to fix. And out of this narrative arises various stories of like hopelessness, critical views, ultimately despair of our sense of, from our sense of worthlessness, perhaps. And invested in this story, this view of our world, each setback or hardship seems to confirm the narrative. So one way or another, we struggle to choose our world. So we keep returning to and investing in the narrative of how my life should be. Or we keep weaving dark stories, trapped in a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. We try over and over again to choose our world. But this is not new at all. This has been going on for thousands of years. For example, Siddhartha Gautama, right, spent much of his younger life living the life that his father had chosen for him. According to the mythology that we have about his life, Siddhartha was protected from the vicissitudes of life. He was never hungry or cold or subject to the pain of others in any deep or significant way. And he was, by nature, it sounds like, talented and skilled physically and mentally. And most of his desires were quickly provided for. He lived a privileged life, as was expected of a person of his rank at that time. And yet, when he was brought kind of face to face, for the first time, with severe sickness, old age, and death, Siddhartha realized the hollowness of his own narrative because he came to see it did not embrace the human condition. And so he began this journey out into the world. Do you choose the world, or do you choose your own narrative? It's not easy to leave our own narrative, our own narrative world, perhaps, because we don't know who will be without it. And before long, we easily create another narrative if we leave one behind. For example, when Siddhartha left his princely life, he became a wandering mendicant, a monk, and soon embraced another narrative. And that narrative said, the body is corrupt and needs to be purified, and this will lead to awakening and bliss. So Siddhartha, as a young man, then tried the path of extreme asceticism, and then realized after a long time it led to a ravished body, even death, and so he gave up that path. And instead, what we call today the middle way. Now, I've noticed today not many people show any interest at all in living an austere life. And still today, many people, though, see Buddhist practice as rather austere or ascetic. And while that is not quite accurate, it is true that this practice is a way out of our narratives and into the world, and it does require some renunciation. For example, we can fool ourselves that we are choosing the world. When I was a young man, I read Zorba the Greek, a story about a mysterious and larger-than-life character named Alexis Zorba. Anyone here read that? Just the old guys, old people. Anyway, maybe you saw the movie. No, it's even older than me. It's also pretty old. At any rate, I wanted to be Alexis Zorba because he was full of passion, fearless in embracing all that life could offer. But that became just another narrative about how my life should be. And I needed to renounce that too. Choosing the world is not easy. We can eat chocolate, dance the night away, maybe have a pint or two with buddies, curl up with a loved one. That is all part of the world, yes. But to embrace the world fully and truly means so much more. In choosing the world, we also choose cancer. We also choose the aging body that can hardly walk anymore. We choose to feel the sorrow and anguish of a loved one's troubled life. Choosing the world is a radical act. I'd like to share with you a short poem written by the Zen teacher Hogen Baize, one of the co-teachers or co-abbots of Great Vow Monastery in Oregon. And he called this poem, as far as I know, it's the only poem he's ever written, but In This Passing Moment. In this passing moment, karma ripens, and all things come to be. I vow to choose what is. If there's a cost, I choose to pay. If there's a need, I choose to give. If there's pain, I choose to feel. If there's sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it's my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is. To choose the world is to see and stand in the world as it is. Pain and pleasure, birth and death, sorrow and joy, it's all there. We are enmeshed in a world far more complex and richer than we can imagine. Our personal visions of our own world shallow by comparison. To not choose the world is to cut ourselves into something small, to calve off from the shadow and the light of this life. I don't remember a time I didn't want to be good. The good boy, the nice boyfriend, the reasonable and thoughtful adult. And even in those days when I longed to be a kind of a popular badass, it was a badass with a good heart. This kind of good, though, can easily lead to suddenly jerking back from the world, wounded by broken expectations. That's not what I meant. I tried so hard and still I'm rejected. This is so unfair. I did way more than my share. How could he do this to me? How easily we withdraw into our own story of being good and the kind of life that should arise from that. Because somehow woven into that story is the unspoken assumption that being good means not having to face the pain and ill ease of the human condition. We can stumble on the unfairness of this life, blinded by the certainty of our own basic good intentions and what should arise from them. At times, we can rest in a kind of satisfied complacency of our goodness, not realizing it's kind of a shallow goodness. For example, recycling regularly, donating money to help the homelessness, all good things to do. And yet, how many of us carefully really restrict our consumption or stop regularly to ask a homeless person how she or he is doing? What does this say about how we understand our place in this world? There's nothing wrong, of course, with recycling or making charitable donations. Yet, what do we hold back? The busyness of modern life and our good intentions can really distract us from our fear of engaging fully in this world, our fear of choosing the whole world just as it is. In the Blue Cliff Record, a collection of koans or stories and dialogues, there's this koan, this case. The great Chinese Zen ancestor Yunmen, teaching his community, said, "Medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. Where do you find yourself?" "The whole earth is medicine," Yunmen said. And yet, how could this be? We know that disease is sometimes medicine, like vaccinations, for example, that poisons can cure, like most cancer drugs or digitalis. The whole earth is medicine, Yunmen tells us. In our fear and confusion, we blame our anguish, affliction, despair, grief, heartache, and pain. Maybe our hurt, etc. We blame that on others. We blame it on the world, or we blame it on our own inadequacies. Not really seeing that all of this suffering, this pain, is born out of our attachment to our own story of what should be. There are, of course, aspects of this world, of this life, that we don't want, would not choose, like sickness, old age, and death. We need to remember that even the Buddha did not conquer these three facets of our human condition. He did not invent cryogenics. Nor did he find the fountain of youth that we associate with Ponce de Leon. The Buddha came to understand the whole world is medicine. Nothing stands outside, separate and alone. Choosing our world, we choose the seemingly certainty of our story. But choosing the world is to choose intimacy with everything, and to choose the mystery of this life. Yunmen challenges us, where do you find yourself? Choose the world rather than your stories about the world. Choose the world rather than your stories about how it should be, rather than your vision about how screwed up this world is. To choose the world is to choose it all, and to choose it all over and over again, plunging into the human condition. And how do we choose the world? Remember Yunmen's question, where do you find yourself? Well, the first place to look, I think, for the world is in oneself. After all, where else could it be? And this is our practice. To study the Buddha way is to study the self, and that's where practice starts. Sitting in Zazen, the spinning of the narrative of our life begins to slow down. Gradually or suddenly, we come to understand that the narrative we've been telling ourselves for so long is just a narrative. That's what we find out when we study the self. We begin to see the pieces and branches of our stories as the illusion of a separate and at times hard done by self. And as we continue to sit and follow our breath, all the notions of me as standing outside of the world little by little fade into unimportance. And finally, as Dogen tells us, we forget the self. And what does it mean when the self is forgotten? What remains when the self is forgotten? The world. Everything that's there now and has always been remains. The only difference is that there's no longer the barrier that had seemed so real for so long. Maureen Stewart was a Canadian Rinzai Zen teacher, one of the first, if not the first, women to teach in the West. She was also quite a well-known concert pianist. And Norman and Kathy Fisher both studied with her for a while. I know of only one collection of her talks, a book called Subtle Sound, The Zen Teachings of Maureen Stewart. She did not have a long teaching career because she developed liver cancer in 1990. After her diagnosis, she continued teaching, and she would tell people, I'm not sick. Many people found this very confusing, some assuming that she was in denial. Here's a part of a talk she gave at Green Gulch. One's posted in the book. She wrote or spoke at that time, "The true face of this universe includes all things in it, good, bad, life, death, health, illness, all of it. There are many so-called healers in the world, but healers cannot bring us wholeness. Healers do not heal us. The healing is already there, in the wholeness. And the great goal of healing is to help the person in need of healing to be aware of this. At the deepest level, the so-called sick person has no sickness. And I am not sick. With deep gratitude to this practice, because of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, because of all of you, because of all of this that we are engaged in together, because of this indefinable, mysteriously unspeakable, marvelous, whatever it is, I really do feel there is no sickness. How will you choose the world? Each of us in our practice must find our own gate. Or maybe I should say gates, because I believe we constantly choose the world over and over again. But the good news is, you don't have to go anywhere special. As Mary Oliver wrote in her famous poem, Wild Geese, you do not have to be good. You don't have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You don't have to do any of that stuff. Isn't it the good news? Dharma gates are boundless. Through each of these gates, we choose the world. We choose our life. Full, rich, mysterious, painful. And to choose anything other is to be diminished. How will you choose the world? Now let's carry this together. How will I choose the world as we go out today? Thank you.